everyone, and welcome to Natalie Saves the World, one podcast at a time. Today, I have Dr. Bruce Chalmer and Judy Alexander here with me. They are co-hosts of the Couples Therapy in 7 Words podcast and both published authors. I'm really excited to have both of them here with me. Bruce brings over 30 years in practice to working with couples primarily and individuals trying to navigate love, trust, and emotional healing. And Judy Alexander is an educator, spiritual leader, and former education director at her synagogue. Judy offers grounded, thoughtful, and often humorous perspectives on relationships, drawing from both professional and personal experience. And Judy is also a recently published author of her new book, The Blue Tent, Erotic Tales from the Bible. So really excited to have you both here with me. Is there anything else you want to add?
I think you covered
it. Not at the moment.
But okay. Let's see. Perfect. What comes up. Okay, awesome. So first of all, I really would love to talk about Bruce, your recent book, Betrayal and Forgiveness. I'd love to hear what inspired your book and why do you think this topic is so important today?
Yeah. Well, you know, I suppose in short, what inspired the book is that so many of the couples I work with are dealing with some kind of betrayal. I once did kind of a seat of the pants guess. It was about close to half of the couples that I see in their first session are dealing specifically with infidelity. And then there's other right. kinds of betrayals as well. So I see it a lot. And I think what really got me to write the book, aside from the fact that I like writing books, I have a couple other books out before that one, you know, what right. got me to write it was how inspiring it is. You know, I find that's one of the most inspiring parts of my job is working with folks who are dealing with really hard, painful stuff and find ways of getting through it and often find ways of getting through it. And this is the part I find super inspiring. They'll find ways of getting through it, again, together or separate, but mm-hmm. often together. And they will say they were grateful for the crisis. They won't say, hey, thanks for cheating, but they will be grateful for the crisis. And I just find that really inspiring. And I, you know, it's kind of the work I like to do. So that's pretty much why that particular topic grabbed me.
And do you think they're grateful for it because it ultimately brings them closer together?
Often. Yeah. It either ultimately brings them closer together or it brings them to a point where they realize, sadly, well, we're two good people, but not for each other. And that sometimes happens too. But either of right. those outcomes, I would consider success. It's not for me to judge what, you know, the couple has to judge, each of them has to judge what's success and what isn't. But often, either way, I've had people say, wow, we didn't realize it, but we were headed for some kind of crisis and here it is. And you know, on from the other side, when they've worked through it, and it's hard and painful work often. But right. when they get to the other side, they will often, yeah, they'll be grateful just for the growth. And sure. and you know, I think most of us can relate to that. If you've lived yeah. long enough, and everybody, all three of us in this conversation have lived long enough to have experienced having our hearts broken or being betrayed some way or other, and that sense of that's how you grow. It's the hard stuff that makes right. you grow.
Life lessons.
Yeah, absolutely.
And hopefully you can learn from it and move on.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
Totally.
And some people yeah. have a hard time moving on. So I think that's another thing that your book is really good about helping, you know, talking about that and how people can go from such a horrible betrayal and how to get through mm-hmm. it.
Yeah, it's true. Some of the folks I talk about in the book actually were hanging on to the pain for decades at times and helping them get through that and be able to see it in a different light and sometimes restore an old relationship and sometimes not. You know, it's not only couple relationships that I work with. Again, whether or not they can restore the relationship, they can feel a sense of healing. Yes, indeed, that is part of what I wrote about as well.
Yeah, definitely. I think, I mean, I can say personally, I'm still going through a heartbreak. I was with my ex for 7 years. There was no betrayal in terms of cheating, but we ultimately decided to end the relationship. Basically, just we wanted different things in life. He wanted to live in Israel his whole life and never ever leave. And I'm very open-minded and wanted to kind of be more of like a free bird, try different places. I don't want to feel like confined or trapped to one place. And we've been apart now for a little bit over a year. And for me, still personally, it's very hard to let go, to fully mm-hmm. release it. And yeah. I don't know why that is. Like, I'm clinging to some mm-hmm. tiny sliver of hope that maybe it'll somehow still work out instead mm-hmm. of just moving forward and moving on. Is that something that you find common? Like, do a lot of couples cling to that hope of just, oh my gosh, maybe there's still a chance at fixing it, even if they ultimately shouldn't be together?
Sure. I mean, couples may, or more likely, one of the couple does, and right. the other couple isn't. And yeah, and you know why you feel that way? Because you're not crazy, you know?
Yeah.
Which is to say, that is a normal way our brains aren't that simple. Our minds aren't that simple. You can know something. It's not that different from when someone dies, you know, when you're in grief, when someone dying, part of you knows it. Part of you knows it right away. Part of you takes a long time to know it. And there's part of our minds that have no concept of time. So that part of our minds want to say, you know, when you say part of you is still clinging on, there's a part of all of us that wants to say, I want it not to have happened. I want to go back and make it not happen.
Yeah.
And that's not practical, but it's very normal part of the way our brains work is that, yeah, it takes a while for all the parts of us to get the word. And that can be measured in years sometimes.
Yeah,
definitely. But I think also kind of, as you both mentioned, the pain is kind of like a huge motivator. Mm-hmm. Like when we go through, when the rug is ripped out from under us, so to speak, and we're forced to change or forced to do something different, it's a huge motivator, way more so than like being in our comfort zone is. And same with betrayal. Like once you go through that, as you said, it can ultimately either bring you closer or show you what you were kind of avoiding, which is that maybe you weren't compatible that whole time. Mm-hmm. I wanted to ask a few more questions about betrayal specifically. Are there any certain betrayals that couples simply can't come back from, in your opinion?
You know, I wouldn't. That's a great question. It actually, this may be an odd segue I'll get to in just a second. I'm thinking about our Germany trip, oddly enough, of all things. We'll get to that. There's a little teaser. We'll get to that.
Okay.
But that phenomenon of, you know, when I think about what can people recover from and whatnot, it's not so much the nature of the betrayal. It's all the circumstances around it. Now, having said that, I suppose there are some betrayals. Yes, actually, I have met folks and, you know, where there was a level of violence that it's like, oh my God, I can't trust my physical safety with this person. That's something that people shouldn't get past, basically. But other than that, you know, I've worked with couples where there's been repeated infidelities and yet they've managed to heal, where there's been just awful emotional, I guess I'd say abuse in various ways that couples sometimes can heal from and sometimes not. That's the interesting thing. And sometimes they can't heal from things that many other people might think are kind of trivial, but to them they weren't trivial. So it really doesn't so much depend on the thing. Now, the reason I suddenly had a thought about that, we actually did in our most recent podcast episode. Judy and I just came back week and a half ago, whenever it was, from a trip to Germany. So, and I titled the episode, Two Jewish Boomers Go to Germany and Talk About Forgiveness.
Love it.
and where what we were visiting was Jewish heritage sites along the Main and Rhine rivers. And of course, when you do that, what do you see? And I have to say, and we said in the podcast, the Germans as a group have been more responsible and more, you know, have really accepted, they've really looked at what happened with a great deal of responsibility. It's really, you know, I appreciate that. Having said that, here we're going to all these places and here's where there was all this Jewish stuff that got wiped out. And here's where there's all this Jewish stuff that got wiped out and so on. I have a section in my book, which I wrote well before the Germany trip, where I say, well, the way I define forgiveness isn't about the relationship. It's about getting the poison out of you. You know, it's an inside job. In other words, so the way I'm defining forgiveness, like you can forgive somebody that you still don't trust. You wouldn't want to restore your relationship, but you can let go of the anger, let go of the panic. That's what I mean by forgiveness. So I said in the book, I said, well, okay, wait a minute. I'm Jewish. Does that mean I could forgive the Nazis? And in theory, if you define forgiveness the way I just did, yes. And it doesn't mean condoning it. You know, that's why I say I could, in theory, forgive the Nazis and still, were I there at the time, would have participated in a war against them if necessary to stop them. But I could still forgive them. Well, we went to Germany and that was really put to the test. And I discovered part of me could. Mm-hmm. And then there was at least one moment I talk about in our podcast where, no, part of me, I was feeling something akin to rage. I didn't do anything violent, but I remember that moment. And so it isn't fully, you know, it's like, yeah, I guess there are some things that's like, boy, it's awfully hard to wrap my brain around fully forgiving that.
Right.
I still think it's important. I don't want to be messed up every time I think about the Nazis.
Yeah. But that's, I mean, evil is hard to forgive. It's like pure.
Well, yes, it is.
Yeah.
Evil. But it's true. Ultimately, we do need to, for ourselves, find a way to cope with it and move on. But yeah, that's a tricky one. That's, I think, a deeper level than just betrayal or infidelity or something. That's tougher to forgive.
I would say so.
Yes. Yeah.
But that is, yeah, it's a good point. And ultimately, because we're the ones who are being harmed by not letting go, right? Like, we're the ones who suffer. But yeah, that's a great point. There are some examples where maybe you can't come back from it. I always wonder about that with infidelity. Like, to me, what is so hurtful about infidelity is more than the act itself. It's the loss of trust.
Mm-hmm.
It's feeling like this person that you trusted with your everything has lied to you. Right. I mean, because they have.
Betrayed you. Yes, exactly. They have. They've lied. They've betrayed you. They've, yeah.
Yeah, there's no infidelity without lying. It's almost like part of the definition. You know, if somebody says, hey, sorry to tell you, but I'm going to go have sex with someone else. It is infidelity, I guess, but it's not the same. I mean, that is a betrayal, but it's different from deceiving someone, lying someone, omitting, you know, that it's often done by omission.
Right.
Yeah.
Which is, in my opinion, more hurtful than the act itself.
Yeah.
Because the act itself, I don't know. I mean, we're human. Like, eventually, if you are only being physical with one person for, let's say, 50 years, there is something exciting about just the novelty of something new. Oh, but
also doesn't have to be a sexual infidelity. It could be an emotional infidelity as well.
Right.
So,
which is almost more hurtful in my, I don't know. They're both hurtful.
They're both pretty hurtful. Mm-hmm. Yes. It just means that, you know, it says to you, I can't trust my partner. And what is it about our relationship that my partner had to turn to somebody else?
Right.
Where
I just recently met a couple for the first time. Mm-hmm. Where I haven't mentioned this to you because it was very recent, where it was a variation on that theme where the problem, there was no sexual infidelity, mm-hmm. but the problem was that when they would get into a fight, one of them would call their parents mm-hmm. in the middle of the fight.
Oh, wow.
And so the other was feeling like, how can I trust you if you're involving? And it's funny because the person, I'm deliberately kind of leaving out gender and stuff.
Yeah,
like
yeah.
This. Yeah. The person who was the one who wasn't calling their parents had a good relationship with the in-laws mm-hmm. before,
mm.
But it was destroyed through all of this. And so they were trying to figure out a way, can they recover trust? And it had a lot to do with that. It's that emotional, it felt, and described it that way. As it felt like infidelity,
yeah,
even though it wasn't actually sexual cheating,
right?
Yeah,
wow, that's very hard. Yeah. Do you think that there is something in particular that can determine whether a relationship can be repaired versus not? Like, is there one determining factor?
Well, the reason we're smiling is like you just played right into my hands, you know.
Oh, that was your next line.
Train
of thought.
So it just so happens, and I don't know how many people are listening and how many people are watching. You mentioned the name of our podcast, Couples Therapy in 7 Words. There's the 7 words. We have merch. There's the cup. Yes. And Judy designed that beautiful logo.
I love the logo.
Yeah. And then those are the 7 words: be kind, don't panic, and have faith. And this is an answer to your question, because that's a little, you know, motto I came up with decades ago when somebody asked me, you know, how do you do couples therapy anyway? Like, what are you really doing? You know, boil it all down. And I realized my first cut on it was to say, I suppose if you really boil it down, what I'm trying to convey to people is be kind and don't panic. And the don't panic is necessary so you can be kind.
True.
Kind in the sense of kinship, kind in the sense of feeling like, oh, this is, we're really on the same team, even if we're disagreeing, you know? If you're in a panic, you can't do that. Well, I started sharing that idea with some of the folks I work with. They said, wow, great idea. Tell me, how do you not panic?
Yeah.
And
I would like to know that as well.
Yeah, exactly. And your question, what is it about the couples that can get through something like infidelity? What's the determining factor? Well, one way I could answer it is the ones who are able to do the work, tolerating the anxiety without panic. Those are the ones who could do it. And I don't have a simple formula for how do you not panic, but I do have a description for the people who seem to be able to do it. They were manifesting what I call faith. Now, what do I mean by faith? I'm not talking about religious faith necessarily. I'm talking about a sense that however painful something is, if you start with the assumption that nobody involved in the situation are crazy or fundamentally evil or stupid, you know, we're all capable of being a little nuts or a little evil or a little stupid at various times. But basically, right. we're all doing the best we can here, you know? If right. you start with that, then if somebody does something that is clearly wrong, you know, morally wrong, and when I'm working with couples, the one who cheated, by the time they get to me, the one who cheated is not saying, oh, it was no big deal, usually. You know, they're usually saying, right. oh, yeah, I did a terrible thing. I shouldn't have, but I did. You know, it's the couples who can come in and say, well, let me give you the opposite. The couples who aren't showing faith are the ones who come in and say, this is terrible. We just have to get back to how it was. You can't get back to how it was. You, right. And that's a way of saying, oh, that was meaningless. You know, I was just crazy. I'll never do it again. You know, forget it. And that's not faith. Faith says, okay, I did something terrible. I didn't want to hurt my partner. And right. yet I did it. We better look at it. It doesn't, not to excuse it, but to understand it. We better understand it. The couples that could do that, that's what I mean by showing faith. They're the ones who heal. Together, again, together or separate, yeah. but they heal. So it's faith. One in one word answered your question. How, you know, what's the key to getting through it? It's faith, as I just described. It's not the same as religious faith. It overlaps, but it's not the same thing.
So you mean more faith in terms of the relationship itself, like having faith that the relationship can persevere or having faith?
No, no, because sometimes it doesn't. No, it's faith in reality. It's faith that says reality's right to be what it is, even when it sucks.
Okay.
It's right to be what, there's a rightness. You know, religious people in terms of Western religions would say, oh, you mean God is good. Whatever God is, God is good. You know, that's a religious take on it. A non-religious take is to say the universe is right to be what it is, even though it has pain in it. You know, the forces involved exist for good reason. We can't possibly understand them all because we're in the middle of it. But there's something right about it. I choose to believe the world is meaningful rather than simply meaningless.
Right.
And so that's, and that's why I chose the word faith as much as anything else, because I realize it has religious connotations. And I didn't want to shy away from that. But I think, you know, I think I was influenced. It's funny. I haven't thought of this for a while, by Rabbi Jonathan Sacks.
Mm-hmm. I used to love him.
Yeah. Yeah.
I would listen to his podcast actually. As
yes.
Well. Mm-hmm. He had some great ones.
Yeah. But R.I.P. I remember his take on the idea that it's when I actually taught a class about one of his books years ago. I forgot the name of his book.
It was Science and Faith or something.
Yeah. Science and Religion. And how they're not in conflict. They're partners.
Mm-hmm.
They deal with different questions. Science tells you what things are. Religion tells you what things mean. And it's that meaning question. You know, you could be a scientist and think the world is meaningless. And you can be a scientist and think the world has meaning. And right. I claim, and this isn't exactly, I don't think this is the way Sacks said it exactly, but I claim that is something you can choose to do. And it actually requires a choice. It's not, there's no way to prove that faith is correct because it's not an assertion of what the facts are. Science tells you what the facts are. You know, that you can test. You can test hypotheses about what the facts are, and you know, science is about coming up with the best explanation. But faith is all about saying, okay, but it's right to be that way. It's a value judgment. You can look at the world and say, it's just full of terrible things. And you can look at the world and say, it is full of terrible things, but it's also full of wonderful things. And I'm saying, yeah, if you look at it from a faith-based perspective, as I'm describing it, the world is basically right to be what it is, even though it's really hard sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
For us mere humans.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it is.
Yeah. And it's all happening as it should, essentially, is what you're saying.
It's all happening as it has to, and it's right that it has to. That's a slight spin. You know why I put a slight spin? I'm avoiding everything happens for a reason, which is sort of what I'm saying. But when that phrase gets used, it tends to say, you know, there's an element in there of, so don't feel so bad. And I'm saying, no, go ahead and feel bad.
Yeah, right.
I don't have to own this or whatever it is. Yeah, it tends not to be very comforting to people when people say that.
Yeah. So I actually study Kabbalah, like I take lessons at the Kabbalah Center. And one of the principles they talk about is that everything's happening for you, not to you. Mm-hmm. And that's really helped me as well in the breakup. Just the fact that because we can't see it always in the moment, right? It feels like, why me? Why did this happen to me? This is so unfair. This is so hard. But ultimately, it's all happening for you, whether that's for you to come together in the end, or for you to not come together, and for you to work on yourself or to learn a lesson, or ultimately there's always some reason that it happened, right?
And see, that I think that fits nicely, at least I'm making it fit nicely with that concept, because that's a choice. Yeah. You can choose right. to say everything happens for you as opposed to you. And mm-hmm. when you choose that, it changes how you experience the world.
Right.
That's a very similar concept.
Or you could choose just to be a victim and
yeah.
say mm-hmm. it's not fair.
Right.
Yes, exactly.
Another right. choice. So my next question was going again off of the topic of betrayal. Is the act of betrayal itself the most painful part, or is it the meaning behind it?
It's the meaning. Well, I think it's yeah. implicit in the word betrayal is the meaning. Do you know, right. It's all kinds of, anybody can hurt us, but only someone with whom we have a relationship can betray us. And the right. betrayal is based on the relationship.
Right.
You know, if a friend of mine says, I cheated on my wife, I can say, gee, that diminishes my respect for you, but it's not a betrayal of me.
Yeah.
Right. If God forbid I cheated on you, that would be a betrayal of you based on our relationship. So it's always based on the relationship, and different relationships offer different opportunities for betrayal. That sounds like a nice way of right. saying it. There's all kinds of opportunities to betray somebody depending on the relationship. So it's sort of implicit in the meaning.
But if it's your romantic partner who, you know, you have so much trust in this person and they're your world, your everything, I think it is especially hurtful when it's coming from your romantic partner who you have a very different relationship with, even than like a parent or a child or a close mm-hmm. friend.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Especially hurtful. Yeah. I've never had to, for now, fingers crossed, I've never experienced infidelity type of betrayal. And I just imagine it would be. Yeah, I'm very fortunate to be able to say that. But I don't know how personally I would handle it. I think it's very, for me, I could see it as being very difficult to ever trust them again, yeah. essentially.
You know, Natalie, it's so interesting because the folks that I work with, so often, this is almost more often than not, in the first session, when they're describing infidelity, the person who is cheated on will very often say, you know, if you had asked me 6 months ago if I would stay with my partner if I found out they cheated on me, I yeah. never would have. And there they are in an office trying to save the relationship. So wow. you never know. It yeah. really is fascinating. Yeah.
No, it's tricky because we all make mistakes, right? We're all human. We're all flawed. We all can have, you know, judgment errors. But to do something when you know how hurtful it is for this person that you care about so much is a serious, serious you know, flaw in judgment. So on the one hand, it could be forgiven. But on the other hand, yeah, I don't know. It's tricky. If it was me, I don't know if I could move past it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And trust them again.
I hope you're never tested on that.
Yeah, me too.
But I guess what I'll say is if you are, you would find out then. And I don't think there's any way to know until you're actually presented with it.
Right. This is an interesting question. I've heard differing opinions on this, but is there any research or correlation between men and women in terms of who is more often to cheat?
The research I've seen is really, it's not real rigorous. First of all, how you define cheating, you know, the numbers I've seen, it seems like it's more men than women, but if we're talking about heterosexual relationships, then who are they cheating with? You know, I guess yeah. you could say, well, a lot of more men are cheating with fewer women, or more married men are cheating than married women. I think that's probably true. More
yeah.
married men cheat. But one of the great advances since feminism is that women are catching up in so many ways, including on right. cheating on their partners. So, no, it isn't. It's certainly not overwhelming either way.
Interesting.
I see plenty of both.
And have you seen any increase in what might be considered cheating with all of these online sources now? So things like OnlyFans or porn or AI girlfriends.
Well, that's, you know, what you're describing. What I've seen is new forms of cheating.
Yeah, right.
So it didn't used to be possible to do a lot of stuff you can do now.
Right.
So some of that stuff has emerged. And it is interesting sometimes. Porn is a great example of that. And then with all of the very, you know, it used to be porn was, you know, looking at a magazine or something. Mm-hmm. And there would be people, almost always women, who would feel like that's cheating. And almost always men would say, no, no, it's not cheating. And then they'd have to figure that out. Now with the internet, there's so many variations of, well, there's basically the same as porn, except maybe it's a video or something, you know, where there's no actual human relationship involved. Then there are these things, like you said, OnlyFans or whatever the other ones, all these different sites you can go and actually interact with someone.
And it's wild.
That feel, I don't know, that to me, that feels like another notch toward more cheating. And then there's the ones, I mean, you know, there's so many different variations. Yeah, the AI ones. Oh, my God. That's crazy. And that's scary. Yeah. And we were talking about that not long ago, that, you know, the notion of having an AI relationship. Well, you remember the movie Her.
Right.
Yeah.
And that was quite a while ago now.
I know.
Maybe like 10 years ago.
Yeah.
It was around 2014, 2015.
Yeah. But that's now happening.
Reality. Yeah.
The weird thing is, of course. And of course, I'm a therapist. You know, there are lots of AI therapists now, too. And they're always understanding, and they never bother you, and they never, you know, they challenge you very gently. That's lovely. But I was saying, no, we weren't talking about this. I know I was talking, somebody was interviewing me who's developing an app that he wants to be useful for both clients and therapists. And that part of it is the idea of the AI being trained on the therapists, you know, listening in on the therapist enough so that it could give answers the way the therapist would.
Wow. And
I said, you know, a problem with that is that in doing therapy with people, it's actually, I think, an important part of the therapy that people see me not at my best.
Yeah.
Because that's true in any relationship. It's like
Agreed.
The trouble with AI is it's always at its best. Whatever.
It's always perfect.
It's always perfect. Yeah. And so, you know.
Well, would you want a perfect therapist?
Would you want a perfect husband? Lord knows you don't have one. Oh, excuse me. No, you don't. I have a perfect wife, but she does not have a perfect wife. And no, I mean, that's, you know, would you want somebody who's like
completely robotic?
Yeah. If it's cleverly robotic, you know, to seem human, but never is a little off, never is having a bad day. Never is. Yeah. I mean, that's just, that would drive me nuts.
I don't know.
Yeah.
Me too. I feel the same as you, Bruce, but it is very interesting now, the rise. We can talk about this as well, but like just the trends that I'm seeing with people my age and younger, where a lot of them are just opting out of human relationships, because especially these young men, because they have all these digital alternatives. They have, like we said, the OnlyFans, the porn, AI, as opposed to a real human woman who's flawed. They're choosing those easy, you know, quick fix options that don't require any investment like a real relationship does. And it's very sad.
It is. And I think that's an extension of something that was already happening before AI even. Because, and, you know, and I'm old enough to remember, I was born, I'm 74. I was born in 1951. I go way back, you know.
No.
I go pretty far back. And what I'm remembering, I mean, don't have to remember that hard. When I was a young man or a teenager, when I was in high school, it was still true. And this is going to sound even more old fashioned than our generation, right? But it was still true that if a boy wanted to impress a girl, he had to seem like he had prospects.
Right.
And I don't even think our parents would have said that, but our parents might have.
Uh-huh.
You know, and of course, you were, I'm a few years older than you, but you were in the same generation.
Mm-hmm.
When you were in high school, would you consider a boy who seemed like he just wanted to sit around playing games all day?
God, no.
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 It just, why wouldn't you?
Because you want to know that he's going to be a good provider.
Ah, exactly.
Mm-hmm.
It was and part of that is, you know, okay, part of that is unfortunate because women of your generation, and certainly old women of my mother's generation, had very few options for actually making a living without a man.
Right.
If you know, if you didn't have a man, you were likely to be poor unless you had
stuck
a man.
At home.
Or- yeah, because the range of jobs available to women was really limited, and they were all badly paid.
Right.
And I remember that from kindergarten. You know, they would say, "What do you want to be when you grow up?" And all the boys were saying, "Yeah, I mean, silly things, cowboy or whatever," but also saying, you know, whatever daddy does. And all the girls, they only had three options that I remember. Do you remember what they were?
Secretary,
teacher, and nurse.
Yeah, actually, I wasn't even thinking of secretary. That's true.
What about the operators?
Teacher, nurse, and mommy.
Mom, okay.
Oh, yeah.
So that, I guess that's four. I guess secretary. I don't remember anybody saying
mommy wasn't work outside the home.
No, but that's what, but right. Lots of women would say that is their occupation.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
That's what they would say. That's what mommy is, you know? So the girls had very few options. That, right. of course, changed. That's a good thing, in my humble opinion, speaking as the guy in the conversation. But it left, and I think it has left young men and women both. You know, the thing I hear from women over the years more and more is, where are all the guys? I mean, where are the men who show up and, like, can make a living?
Yeah.
And so many women, I see this one fairly repeatedly as well, where you have a couple where the woman is earning like three times as much as the guy, which, again, that doesn't have to be a problem, but she's earning three times as much as the guy. They have a kid. She has to keep working while he stays at home and raises the kid. And she's pissed. She's feeling like, I didn't want to have kids to have some, even my husband raise them. You know, again, plenty of couples are fine with that. But plenty aren't. And it's, you know, educated, sort of feminist-minded women often who are the ones saying that. And, you know, and younger women are often saying, I can't find a guy. I can't find a guy who knows how to provide.
I think women want to date. I actually talked about this in one of my earlier episodes. We want to date horizontally or above us, socioeconomically speaking.
Yes.
So now that that pool of men is actually becoming smaller and smaller, and women are becoming more and more educated and having more and more career success, they're finding that there's now a smaller and smaller pool of men available to them who are above them socioeconomically.
Right. Yeah.
It's challenging.
Yeah. And that's, it's interesting because, again, I am old enough to remember sort of, you know, after second wave feminism, sort of, you know, conversations in the late 70s, 80s in there, where to acknowledge what you just said would have been considered heretical in some circles. How dare you think that women want men to be higher socioeconomically with the implication that they could, you know, you could be supported. It's like, oh my God, that's not feminist thinking, you know? And that over time, I think we've all gotten a little more mature and we can have these conversations. And it's like, no, actually there's pretty good evolutionary reason why women would feel that way. You know, it kind of makes sense. We got up on our hind legs. I'm still pissed about that. You know, every time I have a sore hip or a sore knee, I'm pissed about that. But you know, I wasn't around to make the decision. But somebody decided one day, hey, good idea. Let's get up on our hind legs. And so, that means that our species had to give birth to helpless young because the pelvic structure got smaller so that you couldn't, you know, you gave birth to super helpless infants. Our infants are way more helpless than most mammals' infants are.
Yeah.
And so, you know, and stay that way for way longer.
Right. So they needed the mother.
They need the mother. Well, and they can't hold on to your fur.
Right.
Because you haven't got it.
Right.
So the mother's hands are tied up. It's that simple. And so fatherhood is born. You know, you need a guy. You're not going to be attracted to a guy who isn't, you know, if you're going to mate with a guy, mammal, you know, if you're going to mate with a guy and maybe make a baby, you're going to be attracted to a guy who looks like he can support the family. It works better in evolutionary terms. And that's still true.
Makes sense.
Even if it isn't, you know, even if the numbers don't work anymore.
And despite how far we've come, it still tends to be true. Yeah. It's interesting. True. I have a few more questions about betrayal that we didn't get to. Do you have any practical advice for couples trying to move past infidelity?
Well, I mean, I can boil it down to the seven words, be kind of compassionate and have faith. I almost don't have much more specific than that. You know, it's read my book. There's another one.
Hold on my book. Read the book.
I wrote a book and others have written good books too. You know, you're going to go through a time of a lot of turmoil.
Right.
And if you can hang on as well as you can to get through the turmoil and find a way of kind of processing the immediate trauma, that's what the forgiveness part is about. If you can find some level of that, then you'll have a shot at figuring out what you want to do with the relationship. Very difficult to figure that out while you're still freaking out.
Yeah, it's hard. And when you're still, it's like you still love that person so much, but you're also so probably very angry with them or upset with them. Mm-hmm. There's the loss of trust. I imagine many couples imagine the act in their heads over and over. Like they imagine them kissing that other person. They imagine them being intimate with that other person. I probably would imagine that. And that's got to be very, very difficult.
Yes, it is.
And it also, you know, it wears away at you. It's like, what does that other person have that I
don't have?
Is she better than me? Is she better looking? Right. Is she a better kisser? Is she better in bed? Is, you know, like, what does she have that I don't have?
That is a classic from women.
Yeah, it undermines your self-confidence and yeah.
Totally.
Yeah, it's really interesting. You know, there are two reactions that couples will often have. Mm-hmm. And it's sometimes both of these reactions at different times. One, exactly that. I hear that. And again, mostly from women, I hear that one. Mm-hmm. I think guys to some extent, but especially women do that. And then the other piece that's fascinating is when infidelity, and we're talking about sexual infidelity, when infidelity mm-hmm. is disclosed, often a sex life that was sort of almost non-existent between the couple, all of a mm-hmm. sudden they'll be going at it like rabbits.
Really?
Yes, wow. Which you wouldn't think, yeah. And that's not mutually exclusive from actually, Natalie, what you were saying about imagining it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Or what you were saying about, you know, what does she have that I haven't got? Mm-hmm. Both of those things can be true. And it's confusing. It's mm-hmm. just super confusing. But that's one of the reactions that often happens. It's sort of like the sense of, I got to reclaim what's mine, you know?
I almost think about it like competing, like maybe they yeah. feel like, oh, well, now I have to overcompensate or I have to show them how amazing I am in the bedroom mm-hmm. to compete with that person that yeah. They had the infidelity with. Interesting. Wow. I have a question just from my personal experience and my personal story. So, I mean, we don't have to get into my whole breakup. It's a long story. But part of why my ex, so he was actually the one that ended it. The main core issue was the difference in where we wanted to live. He was really raised with this mentality that he needs to be in Israel his whole life, never, ever had the even desire to live anywhere else. He's lived in the same town his whole life. His whole family is similar. Like that was just the culture that they were raised with. Whereas I was raised here in the US. I've lived in 3 countries. I've traveled the globe by myself. I'm very adventurous, very ambitious. And I felt trapped living in one spot. Like if somebody told you, you're based in Vermont, right? So imagine mm-hmm. if somebody told you, you can never ever leave Vermont until the day you die. How would that yeah. make you feel? Right. So I started to feel the last few years kind of started to resent him. There was no infidelity or anything. And we had like a very deep love for each other. But just over the years, I started to resent him and be angry at him because it started to make me feel trapped. And he would always say like, oh, well, we can go somewhere else, but it has to be on like a strict timeline. It has to be for 2 years maximum. And we have to come back here no matter what. Because that was just sort of how a lot of people there are raised. And I couldn't understand this mentality because I grew up here, you know, Americans, we move all over. We move to different cities. Mm-hmm. It's a big country. There's a lot of options. And oftentimes once we hit 18, we move to college, we move far away from our families and we're more comfortable living far apart. So we were going to move to America. Like we spoke to lawyers. We were ready to start the process of doing the green card. We were engaged. Like we were going to move here together. We had a lot of scenarios where, you know, big things happened, whether it was COVID or wars or different scenarios. And it was always the dynamic that I was the immigrant. I needed support. I was very needy in the relationship because I was the foreign one. He was my only family, really. Like I was living an ocean away from my family. And then we had a big fight with his family. And basically after that fight with his family, he never divulged this to me previously while we were making all our plans to move to America together. He had never shared this. And he told me that he did not trust me or he did not trust us that we were strong enough to handle the situation together where he would be the immigrant and I would be the one that needed to help him and be like his rock and be like the one who was really stable and solid. Because all this time it was the opposite. It was like he was the rock and I was the one who was needy and needed help. And there were a few examples of like times when I wasn't there for him and I made mistakes and in a way betrayed his trust, but I had no idea that I had done that and he never shared that with me. So he said that he no longer trusted me and felt like he couldn't trust us as a couple to be in this opposite dynamic where he's the immigrant and I was the one who had to be really strong and be there for him. So now I'm just curious what your thoughts are. Like, do you think it's ever possible to re-earn your partner's trust or regain their trust after they say something like that? Like after they feel like you've lost their trust?
Yeah. My first answer is sometimes.
Right.
That's a pretty wishy-washy answer, isn't it? What do you think?
No, but of course.
Sometimes.
Yeah, and sometimes. Yeah. Yeah. I've seen people regain trust and I've seen people not regain trust. Right. I mean, it just depends on the circumstances. I will note, you know, the story you were just telling. I have a chapter in one of my earlier books, and it's actually going to be a expanded chapter on the one I'm working on now, about how to know when to call it quits. And right. You're describing one of the classic deal breakers, just as simple as saying where you want to live.
Yeah.
That is not just about the geography, but it is often, you know, geography and family and culture and everything like that. Right. That can be a deal breaker between two people who love each other and generally get along. Mm-hmm. And it can still work. You know, that's a classic. The classic of all classics is, should we have kids or not? You'd be amazed the number of couples I work with where they're together for a couple of years before they ever have the conversation and come to discover one of them absolutely does and the other absolutely doesn't. You can't compromise on that. You can't sort of have a kid.
There's no middle ground.
Or not have a kid. And so,
Yeah, and you're also dealing with the cultural difference as well. Yeah.
Right.
So,
which is hard. Exactly. And I think we, for a long time, both tried to convince each other. Like, he tried to convince me that we should stay there forever. I tried to convince him that he should be open-minded and try living somewhere else. And you can compromise to an extent, right? You could say, okay, we're going to do 5 years here, 5 years there. But when it comes to like building a life together and we're going to raise children together, mm-hmm. it's very hard to find, like when you're an ocean apart. It's very hard. Yes. It's one thing if it's like, okay, this person's in Cleveland and this person's in Chicago, let's move somewhere in the middle. And then we're close to both of our families, somewhat close. But when it's, you know, an ocean apart,
ocean
it's
kind of tough. I mean,
Atlantic and 14-hour flight. So it's tricky. Yeah. And it's hard because we loved each other a lot. There was no betrayal. There was no, like, I would say we were like 95% compatible.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But that main 5% was just where we wanted to live.
That's the deal breaker stuff. And, you know, I talk about that. I differentiate between deal breakers and growing pains. And it's amazing. Many people would say we're 65% compatible, but that 35% is all growing pains. And, you know, in theory, not doesn't always work, but in theory, maybe you can grow through that stuff. And then it's not painful anymore, you know. But the deal breaker stuff is stuff that it doesn't matter how much you grow.
Right.
It's like if you don't change your mind, and you know that's the interesting thing. Neither your view nor your ex's view are bad; they're just incompatible. You know, they're not evil; they're just incompatible. It's like you can't both insist that you live here and insist that you don't live here. You know,
you
got to figure it out.
No, exactly. And I mean, we had a great life there. It wasn't like I was so unhappy with our life. It was just I didn't like the principle of anyone telling me, you can't move from this spot forever. That made me feel trapped. And he was the opposite. Like, he really wanted to like put down his roots and stay in one spot. Right. And that was really important to him.
Important to him. Right.
And I think I had this like fantasy all these years that he would come here and we would, I don't know, he would end up really liking it and we'd have a great life here and blah, blah, blah. But at the same time, that's just fantasy. That's not reality. And I think the reality would have been he would have always been longing for his family.
Yeah. And see, you didn't or weren't ready to see the reality.
Yeah.
And it kind of sounds like he made that pretty clear to you from the start. And you thought, well, maybe he'll change his mind over time.
Exactly. Yeah.
So,
And I think when you're young, I mean, we met when I was a baby. When you're young and you've never had your heart broken, you're like, it's fine. Love conquers all. We'll work it out. You know, you
and it ignore.
Yeah, it turns out it doesn't. Bummer.
It is. Exactly. And I think And we think like love conquers all. And we think that these tough topics, like you said, the deal breakers are, you know, we'll find a way to compromise or we'll find a way to find some, you know, common ground. But with things like that, you can't really like with kids versus no kids. You have one kid? Like, that's the compromise?
Yeah, it doesn't work. Yeah, and that's the thing. And you almost, in some cases, like yours is a good example, you really don't know if it's a deal breaker until it becomes one.
Yeah.
No, you thought maybe it wasn't.
Exactly.
It's not inconceivable that it wasn't, but it turned out it was.
Right.
I was okay with the idea of living there, like, long-term for the most part, until the war was like very scary for me. And nobody could have thought in a million years that this war would happen. Like, it was very unprecedented. Yeah. But I think also, like I said, it was kind of the straw that broke the camel's back. Cause for years I was just, even before the war, starting to resent my life there just for that feeling of being trapped. But I was like, no, it's okay. I'll stay here because we love each other. I'll, you know, suffer no matter what. But you can't do that. You have to live your life for yourself.
Yeah.
Even if you love someone so much, if you live your life for them, you're going to resent them.
Ultimately, it doesn't work. Yes.
Yes.
Yeah. But it's sad because two people, yeah, like you said, you can love each other so much and be like very compatible in most ways. But yeah, love does not conquer all, sadly. But yeah, I'm also happy that it happened because it forced me to grow a lot. Like I had to really work on myself afterwards. And I became very, very dependent on him being the immigrant, being very needy for all those years. And now I'm relearning like who I am on my own. And it's been a great lesson, but it was very sad, very hard. We were together 7 years. It was like all my 20s basically. And I think the hardest part has been just the loss of the future that I thought I was going to have, like grieving, as you said. It's basically grieving not just this person who I loved a lot, but grieving that future that I thought I was going to have.
Oh, absolutely.
That's like a song lyric.
Like our songs. We write songs together too. And one of our songs, Holyoke, has that.
The character in the song, which isn't either of us, but the character of the song is grieving for her future. That she was grieving the future she lost when she was betrayed, basically.
It's very hard. I think that's the hardest part.
Our YouTube channel, you can listen to Holyoke.
That's right.
Holyoke. Okay.
Holyoke. It's like Holyoke, like the town.
In Massachusetts.
In Massachusetts, which we have never spent any time in, but we love the word.
Yeah, it's a great word.
So we wrote a song.
Wrote a song based in Holyoke. So.
Oh, awesome. But yeah, I think that's the hardest part with betrayal, breakups, heartbreak. It's just mourning the loss of the future. And also a hard thing for me has been like the loss of the support. Because I had somebody 24/7 around helping me, supporting
and
me.
And you will find somebody else.
Yeah, yeah.
It's hard to see that, but you know, when it's all a life lesson and
totally
somebody better out there for you. Somebody more suited to you.
Or it wouldn't have happened, I think. But yeah, definitely an important life lesson, a lot of important life lessons. So another question I had is just going off of this topic of betrayal is why do we crave both stability and excitement? And how do those needs tend to conflict?
Yeah, and that's actually, I've written about that a lot in my other books. And the upcoming book is really a workbook all about those concepts, stability on the one hand and intimacy on the other is what I call them. And right. We need them both. I claim they're both needs. And the interesting thing, stability just means the anxiety level stays low. You know, you behave in ways that don't necessarily rock the boat too much. You know, that includes things like not being unfaithful. That's all about stability. You know, not having substance issues so that you're mostly sober. That's all about stability. You know, all of that kind of stuff. More or less showing up when you say you're going to show up. That's all about
trust. Stability.
Intimacy is the side of things that is all about feeling alive. And that requires that you tolerate anxiety rather than keep it low, rather than avoid it. Mm. And so that the work of being in a couple, you know, the problem when you have lack of intimacy, that's where betrayals happen. That's where, you know, my favorite metaphor is if you think of a seed and somebody plants paves a sidewalk over it, it's going to try and crack the sidewalk. That's that energy for growth is intimacy. And if a couple's intimacy is compromised, something, it will try and metaphorically crack the sidewalk. And what does that look like? It looks like affairs, or it looks like somebody suddenly saying, I'm out of here. Or, you know, like you were saying, it looks like somebody saying, you know, I have never told you this before, but, and then out it comes, you know, those are all symptoms of lack of intimacy in a relationship that people often don't realize because they prize stability for good reason. Right. So we need them both. And it's their intention with each other, which is why, you know, it makes the whole project of being in a couple challenging at times.
Is there anything that you recommend couples do in order to avoid having that conflict of those two needs?
Well, what you learn, if you learn the lessons you need to learn, is that idea of tolerating anxiety.
Right.
So, you know, we've talked about this in our situation. I mentioned earlier, we're in a second marriage. We've been married for 21 years. And I think we each learned, I can speak for myself. I know I learned through being in a marriage that didn't work out for quite understandable reasons, but whatever. I learned a lot about tolerating anxiety, about, you know, bringing things up when I need to bring them up, or about being able to hear my partner bring things up when she needs to bring something up. And I think you learned something.
Yeah, I think what I learned is don't avoid the hard conversations. and that you have to love and trust each other enough. There's that word trust. You have to love and trust each other enough to be able to say what's on your mind without feeling attacked.
Yeah.
So I think both of us have enough respect for each other, and we can say what we think and feel. And if we don't like something or want to try something or have just differing opinions, we're not afraid to tell each other.
Yeah. And what That's that great. Has required is not panicking about it. You know, I've said this in various ways before. If we had met 30 years before, I don't know if it would have worked, because I don't think I was mature enough.
No, I don't
think you probably were, but I don't know. And I wasn't. And it does require a lot of maturity. It's that, and the maturity is all about that. It's about hearing things that challenge something important without freaking out, so you can still hear. And so, you know, I think we each discovered we were both at that level of maturity when we got together that we could say things and risk it. And our respective responses kept supporting the idea that, oh, it's safe to say these things. So then after a while, you stop being so anxious about it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's sort of like, well, I'm not anxious about it because it's always gone well. So it keeps going well, so I'll say what I want, and you know, with compassion.
Yeah. Right.
And you'll say what you want, and it seems like it works just fine.
I think because when you're in the kind of relationship where I was clinging to this person, you're afraid of their answer. You're afraid that you might get an answer you don't want, and then it's going to end.
Exactly. That's why you avoid the conversation.
Whereas if you trust each other and you do, you know, you're completely honest from the get-go. And once you've been hurt before, you're less afraid because you're like, okay, I'd rather end this now than waste 10 more years with this person if we're not truly compatible.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I was single for 5 or 6 years before I met Bruce and, you know, did my share of dating and knew exactly what I didn't want.
Yeah.
I wanted. Well, I had an idea and I knew when Bruce came along, that's what I wanted.
Totally. But it's better that way. And I think
much better that way.
This is also why I'm grateful that I was hurt and I had the heartbreak, because now I would date in a totally different way. And I wouldn't
Absolutely.
Avoiding those conversations. I would have those conversations right away, because then if you break up after a month, it's much better than, 7 years.
That's right.
10 years. Let's talk about your book, Judy. Can you explain?
Okay. Well, my book is called The Blue Tent, Erotic Tales from the Bible. And, it's interesting because I never thought of writing erotica before. I was in Jewish education. I was a school teacher. I worked in advertising for years. I've always written, but more plays than anything else, or short stories. But doing this podcast actually opened me up to a lot of different ideas, probably around sex. We've interviewed so many people over the past 5 years of doing the podcast. We've interviewed sex therapists and sex experts and sex counselors and madams.
Former sex workers.
And just talked to a lot of therapists about, you know, sex and relationships. So I thought, what do I have expertise in? Well, I have expertise in Jewish education. And I don't want to say I'm an expert in sex, but, you know, have enough background in
it. I would say so. But,
yeah. So hearing about what couples, spicing up their sex lives. So I thought, I did a little bit of research to see if there was a lot out there on biblical erotica, and there didn't seem to be a lot out there. So I said, I'll take some of these very, racy Bible stories and I'll just fill in the sexual details. So,
and I mean, between the text of the, in the Bible and Midrash, like you said, it writes itself. I mean, you happen to write it very skillfully and beautifully, but there, a lot of the stuff that isn't exactly in the text, you found in Midrash. There's all kinds of stuff in there.
Right, commentary on Bible stories. And these are thousands of years old. So it's not, I don't have the Midrash in there of Adam having intercourse with every animals.
No, you don't have that one.
I don't have that one in
there. That one's not much.
I try not to be kinky. but there are, you know, there's other midrash, you know, about Lilith. I brought her in. There's a story of Adam and Lilith. And then there's the story of Adam and Eve, which is she's like the counterpart to Lilith because, you know, she was the submissive one, the passive one, not the aggressor. Yeah. So and the sex lives of Adam with Lilith versus Adam with Eve. And then, you know, Abraham and Sarah and Joseph and Mrs. Potiphar. And it goes on and on. Tamar and wow. Judah, you know, mm-hmm. pick a couple there and they're probably in there.
Wow. King David.
King David. Oh, well, I got a couple of King David.
He was pretty notorious.
Michal,
right? Yeah, David.
And Jonathan.
Yeah, David, Michal, and Jonathan.
That's yeah, there's that one. Creole. And David and Bathsheba.
Bathsheba.
Yeah.
And then Solomon and the Queen of Sheba.
Right. In there. Yeah, yeah,
yeah.
Wow. Yeah. So everything. A little bit of everything.
All the good stuff.
Yep.
And how did you did you just take the existing biblical story and then elaborate on it? Or did you?
Yeah, I added sex. Detailed sex.
Okay.
Well, yeah, I mean, you added the explicit parts that were sort of implicit in the story.
Yes.
Mm.
Yeah, I built on the stories and on the midrash and then filled in the sexual details.
Wow.
Right.
Who would you say is your target audience?
People that like reading erotica.
Okay. Well, people like reading erotica, especially if they also... Well, if they're not freaked out by the idea of it being Bible characters, and there are many people who would be not only not freaked out, but really
appalled. Intrigued. Oh, yeah.
Well, no, there's the
appalled.
I'm saying on the other side, there's also people who would find, like me, for example, because we do a lot of Torah study, you know, I mean, Judy is a retired Jewish educator, and, you know, we read Torah in Hebrew and, you know, engage with it. And for people who love it and aren't freaked out by the erotica, it's really wonderful.
It's just another midrash.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
You feel connected to it. Yeah, yeah, for sure. Wow, amazing. No, I didn't know if you had like a specific niche audience, like X age range or X, I don't know, demographic.
Adults.
Yeah, just all adults.
That's why it's under a pseudonym, because I still train kids for Bar and Bat Mitzvah.
Yeah, oh, wow. People in our community are well aware.
They all know about
it. They know that she did it, and they think it's cool. So. Yeah. A rabbi thinks it's cool.
Amazing. No, it's very innovative and very creative. It's a very, very cool concept. Amazing. Well, basically, I just wanted to ask, how can my audience connect with both of you? Where would you recommend they find you? Where should they follow you, etc.?
Well, we have our podcast website, ctin7.com, CT for Couples Therapy, and 7, the number 7.com. CTIN7.com, CTIN7. Bruce has his
BruceChalmer.com is the way to get. That's information about my practice, information about my books, information. There's a link there.
To get to the podcast.
I have a newsletter. I have a bunch of videos on there, all that stuff. And there's also LariaZilbert.com for information about the Blue Tent.
And he also, Bruce has his YouTube channel.
Yeah, I have
a where YouTube channel. Watch the video, watch the podcast, as well as listen to all our songs.
That's right.
Oh, like yeah.
And a bunch of other, yeah, there's a lot of, I should organize that channel. It's just the Bruce Chalmer channel. It has all kinds of stuff sort of mushed in together. So that's there's
because he does a lot of music.
They do a lot of music as well.
We do some songs together, but most of it is Bruce's music that he does.
Wow, amazing. You're so multifaceted, so talented. Okay. So thank you both, Dr. Chalmer and Judy Alexander, for speaking with me today. We didn't save the world today, but I hope you enjoyed, and I really enjoyed our conversation. So thank you for listening to Natalie Saves the World, one podcast at a time.
Thank you for having us.
Yes, thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Thank you both so much for your time. It was a pleasure, and have a great day.